Welcome, everybody, and thank you all for coming. I want to start with a book, which is not on the source sheets. It's a book called The Artless Jew by Dr. Kalman Bland. Dr. Kalman Bland was a professor of Jewish studies at Duke University. He actually passed away 2 years ago. And the book is about the following thesis. He pointed out that many people, many art historians, many philosophy professors assumed that most religions around the world have a large artistic tradition. Christianity has a large artistic tradition, their paintings, their sculptures, their statues. Islam has a large artistic tradition, also paintings and sculptures and things like that. The assumption was that Judaism was anti-iconic. It was non-visual. Anybody want to take a guess as to where this idea came from, that Judaism was a non-visual religion? Exactly. The second commandment, the second of the Seder Debros, says, "Lo taseh kol paso," you should not make a representation of Hashem. And the argument was that there basically, if you go through Jewish history, there wasn't so much Jewish art. While the medieval Christians were painting all these fancy paintings and making these fancy sculptures for their churches, Judaism, Jews in general, were anti-iconic, iconic meaning visual, and most of the religion was given over, was transmitted, the values are transmitted via text, via learning, via hearing. This is an idea that's not just from the secular world. If you look at Rabbi Jonathan Sachs' commentary to the Koran Seder under Shema Yisrael, he basically says the same thing. So other religions focus on sight, on seeing God, on seeing things. Visual means there's something material in front of you that you're able to see. But we Jews, our call is Shema Yisrael. Everything is auditory. We're trying to sense something that's not visual, sense something that's not material, something that can't be seen. The voice of Hashem is heard. It's not actually seen. And this is generally speaking true. However, what Kalman Bland tried to show in this book, and what other people past him and before him also tried to show, is that it's not entirely true. That Judaism, as far back as we go, particularly if you look at the archaeology, particularly if you look at what material findings we have from the Byzantine period and afterwards, there is an artistic tradition. There is Jewish art. There are Jewish representations of different symbols you find all over the place. Any ideas as to where you find these symbols, where you find Jewish art in the ancient world from Byzantine and on? Sorry? Any ideas? Coins is one. That's what we have in front of you. Have you guys seen the shuls in the Galilee, the ancient shuls? Yeah. You guys have seen them? Is MMY taking you, or will be taking you in the future? So you'll see, what do you see in the ancient shuls? Some lot of them. You see mosaics on the floor where they have pictorial depictions. They have artistic depictions of different stories of Tanakh. And this challenge, on the one hand, it's interesting. You get to look at these pictures, you look at the art, you look at the representations, you look at the figures, and you try to see the way Jews 2,000 years ago thought about or able to visualize and therefore portray the stories in Tanakh and the Midrashim. Sometimes it's challenging and sometimes it fits. If you've seen some of the ancient shuls, sometimes it's challenging because we know the Chazal were very against Avodah Zarah. That's the Torah is very against Avodah Zarah. And yet, what do we find in some of the ancient shuls? We find things which look like Avodah Zarah. We find zodiacs. We find the pictorial depictions of the 12 zodiacs. It was exactly the way you would find them in Greek zodiacs. Some of them have Helios, the god, in the middle. Some of them don't. Some of them are firmer than others. And you have to figure out, were Chazal, what is the Torah's perspective on this? Were these people who are non-rabbinic Jews who just did this without asking the rabbis? Was it something that Chazal, that Amoraim and Eretz Yisrael, who were around during the time period, were pro, were they against? And an entire sugya is there. The way I want to start today is by looking at not the mosaics and shuls, but two coins, and see what these coins, what the pictures on these coins might have represented for the people who minted them, for the people who used them, and then see whether or not there actually is representation of this idea. This idea is in consonance with the ideas we have in Chazal, with the ideas we have from a traditional Torah perspective. So if you look right beneath the camel with the sukkah on top, there is a coin there. If you look at it's from antiquities.org.il. This is the Rishut HaAtikot, the official government body that deals with ancient things in Israel. This is from their website. So this is a coin. If you look at the Hebrew underneath, Matbea Barzona Barunza Shel HaMered HaGadol MiYerushalayim. What is the Mered HaGadol, the Great Revolt? Any idea what that refers to? Sorry? I can't hear you. No, it's before Bar Kokhba. The Maron Gadol, the Great Revolt, refers to the year 67 through 70 CE, when the Jews rebelled against Roman rule. And how did that fight end? What happened in the year 70 CE? The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. This was, the Romans had already been ruling Eretz Israel for several decades, since around the turn of the millennium, since around the year zero, a little bit before. The government was very corrupt, the taxes were oppressive, economic conditions were bad. Jews wanted sovereignty, Jews rebelled. As we know from the Gemara and Gittin, the Chachamim, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Chazal, had different opinions, or were a little bit ambivalent about this type of revolt. In the end of the day, people revolted. In the end of the day, the revolt was crushed. Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, and the situation was worse afterwards than it was before. This was a coin minted in the middle of the Maron HaGadol, in the middle of the Great Revolt, by the Jews who revolted against Rome and set up their own autonomous government. What pictures do you see on these coins? An Esrog on top. And what do you see on the bottom? A lulavim, hadasim, and aravos, right? So they minted several types of coins during this time period. Minting coins was one of the recognized official functions of a government. The Rambam even says al pi halacha. Forget history. The Rambam says al pi halacha. There are different halachos that are relevant for a government. For example, if a marauding band of robbers takes over MMY, it takes over Baca, and asks you all to give them a lot of money for taxes, you don't have to pay them taxes luckily. It's not considered dina. It's not considered a law of the government because they have no authority. They're just a marauding band of robbers. At what point does a conqueror, at what point does a marauding band of robbers get the status of an official government such that dina d'machusadina, the fact we have to follow the law of the country applies to them? The Rambam says one of the things is if they start minting coins. If they start minting coins, that means they're an official government. They're performing the official functions of a government. So they wanted to mint coins, these rebels, the Mordim against Rome. They minted a coin with the Dalai Aminim on it. Curious. What might you think they should be minting coins with? What types of pictures? Torah. Okay. Anything else? I can't hear you. Magen David. Maybe. I think that was a later symbol. Any other things you might think? Beit HaMikdash, they have coins with the Beit HaMikdash on it, that they do have. Good, let's bracket that. They minted coins, among other things, with the Dalai Aminim. Good. Turn the page. 60 some odd years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the failure of the first revolt, Bar Kokhba comes on the scene. We know very little about Mered Bar Kokhba. We know very little about who he was as a person, about the blow-by-blow of his rebellion. Chazal give us little snippets of his personality, of what happened during the rebellion. We know a little bit more from some of the Roman historians. Bar Kokhba also, he was fabulously successful in the beginning of his rebellion. We know that he also established his own semi-autonomous or autonomous government. We know that Rome had to pull legions from Europe to come to Eretz Israel, to come to what they called afterwards Palestine. The Romans were so upset with Bar Kokhba that that's when they officially changed the name of the province from Judea to Palestine, because they were upset with the Jews after the second major rebellion. But we know that it took them a lot of manpower. They had to bring legions in from Europe. Bar Kokhba was fabulously successful at the beginning, and then eventually became a failure. This is also one of the Bar Kokhba coins. What's on one side of the Bar Kokhba coin? What's on the left side, the top? The Beis HaMikdash. What's on the right side? Sorry? Lula. Also, Lula, Hadassim, and Aravos. And the little thing on the bottom left seems to be an Esrog. And again, it's the same theme, the same image, the same picture. They clearly, and the words, it's written in Ksav Ivri, in the ancient Hebrew script. It says, the Chayrut Yerushalayim. The third year of the Chayrut Yerushalayim, for the freedom of Yerushalayim, they managed to kick the Romans out of Yerushalayim for a couple years, and this is their coin. And then 2 years later, a year and a half later, the rebellion was squashed. And again, the question is, why Lulav and Esrog? The Beis HaMikdash makes a lot of sense. They wanted to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. It was messianic. They wanted to kick the Romans out and regain Jewish sovereignty and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was still within living memory of some of the older people. We're talking about 65 years after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But why the Lulav and Esrog? What does that have to do with Mered Bar Kokhba? What does that have to do with the great revolt of the Jews who probably were not necessarily the biggest rabbinic followers, but they still chose to put Lulav and Esrog on their coins. Any ideas? Why Lulav and Esrog Adasim Varevos? Well, based on Rabbeinu Shani Taragin spoke about earlier, any ideas? What does Lulav and Esrog represent? I'm sorry, Yuna?
I said an agricultural symbol.
It's an agricultural symbol. Good. But what else does Lulav and Esrog with Asim Varevos represent? Broader than just agricultural of what? Good. Gratitude to Hashem for the land. It's insight.
Thank you.
If you... 2 years ago in this forum, I spoke about also why Lulav and Esrog were chosen. The lulav was a symbol of military victory. That was true throughout. That was true throughout the ancient world, and there's even a medrash that says that. Anybody know of a medrash that speaks of the lulav as a symbol of military victory? There's a medrash that says that after Yom Kippur, there's this fight between the Jews and the non-Jews, and it's like a court case. Jews and non-Jews come before God, and there's a court case between them. And after Yom Kippur, we don't know minitzeach. We don't know who won. So what do the Jews do couple of days after Yom Kippur to show that they won? They carry around their swords, they carry around their lulavim. The lulav is a symbol of military victory. The Chashmonaim, according to the Book of Maccabees, when they re-enter the Beis HaMikdash, they re-enter the Beis HaMikdash with lulavim, even though it was Hanukkah. Why? Again, lulavim are a symbol of military victory. That's one interpretation. You can look on that Shir in Yitzhak if you're interested in hearing more about that. But more broadly, what do not just the lulav, but the Dal and Minim as a whole represent? Represents Eretz Yisrael. If we look in source number 3, Rivka ben Sasson, I do not know who she is, but she has a fascinating article in the Bar Ilan Journal of Jewish Arts from a couple years ago. It's free online if you want to look it up. She surveys the different places where the Dal and Minim pop up in the ancient Jewish world, from coins to burial sites to floors of shuls. And she tries to figure out, based on the context, what is the meaning of the Dal and Minim? What did they represent to the people who use them in these contexts? What does she say? It's at the bottom of page 2, source number 3. Wants to read this juxtaposition? Please.
This juxtaposition of the four species with the facade of the temple, together with the inscription L'Cher Yerushalayim, for the Garden of Jerusalem, transforms them into a representation of the temple and the land of Israel, as well as a symbol of the redemption of the people.
So what did the Dal and Minim represent to these Jews who were rebelling against Rome? The Beis HaMikdash, redemption, and Eretz Yisrael. And redemption within Eretz Yisrael. What were these groups of people trying to do? They were trying to rebel against Rome. They were fighting for nationalistic reasons, for religious reasons. They wanted Eretz Yisrael to be under Jewish sovereignty. They needed a rallying cry. They were constantly trying to mobilize the people to join them in the revolt against Rome. So what symbol, among other symbols, what symbol did they choose to use as a rallying cry, as a representation of their mission? The Dal and Minim. The Dal and Minim represented Eretz Yisrael. It represented the Geula of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, when your average Jew saw these coins with the Beis HaMikdash on one side and the Dal and Minim on the other side, they thought, now we have something to fight for. We're not fighting. They didn't put matzah, they didn't put other mitzvos. They put Dal and Minim because Dal and Minim represented Eretz Yisrael. It reminded the people what they were fighting for. Again, this is Rivka ben Sasson's analysis based on the context of where these pictures appear. Once we have this historical analysis, we have to ask the question, is this true? From a Torah perspective, from a traditional perspective, from a Chazal perspective, do the Dal and Minim really represent this? Matzah probably doesn't represent Eretz Yisrael. Lots of other mitzvahs that we do probably don't represent Eretz Yisrael. The people in the end of Bayit Sheni clearly thought that the Dal and Minim represented Eretz Yisrael. Is that an idea that's true? Were they tapping into a true Torah idea? And the answer is that, at least according to some people, definitely yes. They were certainly tapping into a true Torah idea. And one perspective in the holiday of Sukkos, there are many perspectives, one perspective in the Chag of Sukkos is that it's hodaf to Hashem. It's giving gratitude to Hashem for Eretz Yisrael. Because many of you, or maybe all of you, have seen these Makaros already earlier today, like 2 hours ago. So let's just skim through them very quickly, and then we'll get to an additional point. Who says this? I figure to tell me which of these Makaros you went through previously. The Rashbam, in source number 5, Parakov Gimel Pasuk Mem. The Torah says, you should sit in your sukkah and take the Dal Aminim, perhaps, So that your people should know, your generation should know, that you dwelt in a sukkah. Hashem says, I caused you to dwell in a sukkah when I took you out of Eretz Mitzrayim, when you're in the Midbar. So, if there's a machlokes, what sukkah refers to, Anani Akavod or Sukkos Mamish, if it's Anani Akavod, everything makes sense. If it's Sukkos Mamish, the question is always going to be, what's the point? Why are we remembering, why do we have a 7-day chag to remember the fact that we dwelt in booths in the Midbar? So if you guys saw it already, you could fill it in. What does the Rashbam say is the pshat reason as to why we want to remember Sukkos Mamish, that we dwelt in booths when we came out of Mitzrayim? Sorry? That's going to be the next source. Look at the Rashbam in the underlined parts. Or so let's start from the beginning. It sounds like the pshat in the pasuk, like the Rashbam is always after the pshat, is that it's referring to Sukkos Mamish, that Hashem wants us to remember that we dwelt in simple booths. Why? This is the reason. Sukkos falls down agriculturally at the end of the agricultural cycle, when you're filling up your granaries with the bounty of the previous season. So what does Hashem want us to remember then? And what does Hashem want us to do at that moment? Thank Hashem for giving us Eretz Yisrael. To remember where we came from historically, that we came from a Midbar. We had nothing. And Hashem gave us this beautiful land filled with grain, filled with bounty, filled with beauty. And that's why Hashem wants us to remember these things. And that's why He told us to sit in the sukkah. Look at the underlying part. The Mantizkru ki basukos ha-shafti is b'nei Yisrael b'midbar abayim shana. We started off in the Midbar without anything, without land. It's a way to remember our humble beginnings, not get haughty about it, but give thanks and gratitude to Hashem, who is the one who gave us this land. That's the mitzvah of Sukkah. Is that true about Dal Aminim? Is that true about taking the Lulav Adasim, Lulav Adasim, Esrog, and Arevos? Lulav Esrog, Adasim, and Arevos. So I think this is also in the previous source sheet. According to the Rambam in Morning Bukim, that's exactly the reason why we take the Dal Aminim as well. Let's read it inside of the English. Somebody want to read it? The Rambam in Morning Bukim is written in Arabic. So the English translations and the Hebrew translations are equally translations. Considering I don't speak medieval Judeo-Arabic, and you guys probably don't speak it either, I figure there's no reason to prefer the Hebrew over the English, considering they're both translations. So does anybody want to read the English, I believe? Michal, please. Thank you. Right, so the Rambam gives you the basic reason why he thinks we take the Dal Aminim. I'll pick shots again. And there's lots of symbolism in Dal Aminim. You think of Dal Aminim, you think of the Medrash, that they represent four types of Jews. And they represent the four different limbs in the human body. The Rambam says, what's the pshat? What's the simple explanation as to why we take the Dal Aminim at Sukkos? To say thank you to Hashem for Eretz Yisrael. These four species grow in Eretz Yisrael. They're beautiful. They smell nice. They stay fresh. They are pleasant for the person to look at. They're aesthetically pleasing. And the Chag, which is all about giving thank you to Hashem for Eretz Yisrael, we take these Dal Aminim that are indigenous to this area, And with them, our Pesimcha, with them, we're able to say thank you to Hashem for giving us this land. There are other expressions of this idea. The Abar Barnel is just an interesting one. I hadn't seen this before like 2 weeks ago, so I figured I would share it with you. The Abar Barnel says that there are three chagim, the Shlosh L'Regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. And Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos, each one say thank you to Hashem for a different major gift that Hashem gave to us. Let's read it inside. The Abar Barnel gives you an analysis of the chagim and says there are two things remaining that we should know about. Why are there three of the shalosh regalim and not more or less? V'yomer b'sibasze she Yisrael kiblu Hashem Yisbarach gimel chasadim gedolim. There are three major acts of kindness Hashem did for the Jewish people historically. Go through Tanakh, go through Chumash. These are the three major events. These are the three major themes. Yitzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, and Yerushas Eretz Yisrael. Pesach is obviously corresponding to Yitzias Mitzrayim. Shavuos corresponds to Matan Torah, which leaves Sukkos as a chag to thank Hashem for Yerushas Eretz, the Eretz Yisrael, which is the third major matana, third major chesed that Hashem did for the Jewish people. So according to the Abar Barnel also, he's building off of the Rambam, building off of these earlier Merkaros, Sukkos, again, Sukkos has many themes, has many layers. It's celebrating the Tara we got in Yom Kippur. It's celebrating unity of the Jewish people. It's an agricultural holiday that's not necessarily connected to Eretz Yisrael per se. But according to these Mefarshim, on a Pshat level, Sukkos is really about thanking Hashem for Eretz Yisrael. In which case, going back to those coins, that the Merid, if the Merid Gadol, Merid Bar Kokhba, makes perfect sense putting ourselves in the minds of those rebels, in the minds of the Jewish revolters, in the minds of the soldiers, that they would want to put the Dalon Minim on the coin, because that would be a rallying cry for the people to remind them, to mobilize them as to why they were fighting. Let's look at one more source, which is going to connect Eretz Yisrael to Sukkos, and then a couple more specific sources. And my hope is that in the next 25 minutes or so, we'll see how this idea, as opposed to just being ephemeral, as opposed to just being a personal idea for me and you, that we're supposed to thank Hashem for Eretz Yisrael on Sukkos, it actually might have been a major motivating factor for some of the early Aliyot to Eretz Yisrael, and was also plays in as a major factor in religious Zionist ideology. So you can sort of connect the mindset of the Jews from Merid Bar Kokhba, the mindset of the Jews from the year 70 CE, when they revolted against Rome, wanting Jewish sovereignty, and the early people who made an aliyah in the modern era to Eretz Israel, who also drew upon Sukkos as an image, as a symbol, as a thematic idea, as a motivator for their aliyah, for wanting to once again reconnect to Eretz Israel and regain sovereignty here. Good. In addition to these makoros that connect Sukkos and Eretz Israel in general, there are more makoros that connect Sukkos, the holiday of Sukkos, with a very specific time period in the history of the relationship between the Jews and Eretz Israel. Look at the Yerushalmi and Sukkah, Perek Beis Halacha Yod. Source number 8. The Mishnah says, again, this is a random halacha. Not a random, it's a pretty important halacha, but it's not a place where you would think to find the connection between Sukkos and Eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah says, Kol Shivas Yamin, the 7 days, Osa Adam Asukaso Keva Ves Beso Arai. You're supposed to make your Sukkah Keva and your house Arai. What is the meaning of Keva and Arai? What's Keva? Set, permanent? What's Arai? Temporary. Good. So you're supposed to make your Sukkah set and permanent, and your house Arai. Good. How do we know that? What is the pasuk in the Torah that tells us you're supposed to be in the sukkah on Sukkos? What's the verb used in the Torah? Basukos teshvu shivas yamin. What does it mean teshvu? Lashavet. To settle or to sit. So how do Chazal know? How do we know that Basukos teshvu shivas yamin means to dwell, to make it your permanent home? And not lashevet, and not to sit. Look at the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi is commenting on the Mishnah, explaining the Mishnah. Ksiv basukot teshivu, you should dwell in your sukkah. Ein teshivu el tiduru. The word l'shaved l'sh teshivu means to dwell. Kamad at amar, like the pasuk says, v'yirashchem osa v'shavtem ba. What does that pasuk mean? V'yirashchem osa v'shavtem ba. Supposed to inherit it and v'shavtem and dwell in it. What is that referring to? Eretz Yisrael. So the way, the same way the shavtem regarding Eretz Yisrael clearly doesn't mean to sit, because it's not about sitting in Eretz Yisrael, it's about living in Eretz Yisrael. So too, the basukot teshivu shivat yamim doesn't mean you're supposed to sit in the sukkah, it means you're supposed to live in the sukkah. That's a halacha drasha. This teaches us a halacha about the halacha of how we're supposed to live in the sukkah. But very clearly, the Yerushalmi is assuming a thematic connection between the mitzvah of sukkah and what part of Eretz Yisrael? What time period? The entering Eretz Yisrael, the conquering of the land. Good. Hold that thought for a second. So it's not just giving gratitude for Eretz Yisrael in general. You're a farmer. You've been on this farm for generations. You're a 10th generation family member on this particular plot of land. You're giving thanks to Hashem for your particular bounty and your particular chelek. There's something else going on. We're supposed to be giving thanks to Hashem for that original moment when Jews were able to enter Eretz Yisrael. Good. Source number 10, I think, was on Rabbi Nitzchani Terrigan's Makoros as well. But let's just read it together for the sake of putting it in this context. Source number 10 is from the Sefer Orkeach. Sefer Orkeach is a Lazar of Worms. One of the Ashkenaz, a later Ashkenazi Rishonim, if I recall correctly. If anybody here is, this is not a plug for why you're a Stern, but if anybody's planning on going to Stern, a friend of mine, Dr. Chai Sima Konigsberg, just received her doctorate on the Rokeach. She did her doctorate on the Rokeach's philosophy, and she's now teaches at Stern. So if you're interested in the Rokeach, she's the person to go to. She's like the expert, she's like the world expert now. So I meant to email her beforehand to see whether or not this idea is like a major theme in the Rokeach or not, but it slipped my mind with everything else that's going on for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but I could try to find out. He points out as follows. The same question we started with, that there's a machlokes in the Gemara if sukkos refer to the Nanei HaKavod or to sukkos mamish. If they refer to Nanei HaKavod, great, everybody understands it's a miracle. If they refer to sukkos mamish, so why is that important? So the Rashbam said, it's to remember the contrast between your lives in the Midbar and your lives in Eretz Yisrael. Rokeach says, it's referring to very specific sukkos, very specific booths. Which booths is he referring to? Let's read it inside. V'ish mefarshim, k'shetzaru al Eretz ha'amori, shel Sikon v'og, on top of page 5, when they besieged the lands of Sikon and Og, v'akrakim sheba Eretz Kanan, and the cities in Eretz Kanan that they were conquering, Az Yashvu Yisrael Basukos. Which sukkos are we remembering when we sit in our sukkah? The military sukkos, the military booths that the Jewish soldiers sat in, that they lived in, when they were going through Eretz Yisrael and conquering it. Again, it's a very, very interesting thought. Where is it coming from? How does he know that we're supposed to be remembering the entry to Eretz Yisrael, the conquering of Eretz Yisrael, the effort we had to employ to gain Eretz Yisrael, when we have the mitzvah of Sukkos on Sukkos? If you're interested in hearing more about this Rokeach, Rabbi Baruch Simon, one of my rabbeim from Yeshiva University, has a shiur in Y.U. Torah, which is entitled A New Perspective on Sukkos, and it's all basically achronim around this Rokeach, trying to explain where this Rokeach got the idea from, and ramifications of this Rokeach. He titled the shiur A New Perspective on Sukkos, but it's not intuitive. It's not something we normally think about when we think of sukkah. We normally think about leaving our comfortable homes and trusting in Hashem Bitako, and sitting b'tzela damnusa, sitting in the shade of the shechina. Usually there's not necessarily a connection made between living in the sukkah and conquering Eretz Yisrael, entering Eretz Yisrael. So far we have two makoros, the Yerushalmi that connected sukkos teshvu with the v'rashim osavi shavtemba, and this Rokeach that connects the whole mitzvah of Sukkos with the military booth that Bnei Israel sat in, lived in, on a temporary basis when they were conquering Eretz Israel. One more source. One of the I would say, I don't know, the strangest, but one of the most interesting minhagim or halachos that we have on Sukkot is circling the bima with our lulavim and esrogim. Again, this probably this applies more on the men's side of the milchitza than the women's side of the milchitza, but it's like a parade of lulavim and esrogim. The Mishnah says that they did this in the base of the Mikdash as well. The Mishnah and the Gemara, at least the Talmud Bavli that we have, don't explain where this comes from. Why? We don't parade around a table, around the Mizbeach with matzos on Pesach. We don't parade around the Mizbeach with shofars. Why do we parade around the Mizbeach with lulav and esrog? The Talmud Yerushalmi has two words, to explain the origins of this halacha. Look in source number 11. Osa yom akifin as a Mizbeach shava pamim, and Hoshana Rabba, they would encircle the Mizbeach 7 times. Amar of Acha, zecher liyericho. What happened at Yericho? They circled the city 7 times. The first 6 days once, and the seventh day they did it 7 times, they blew the shofars, and the walls fall down. We're trying to reenact the conquest of Yericho over the course of the holiday of Sukkot. And again, at first glance, it's very random. It's like this seems like an isolated makar, disconnected from the rest of Sukkot. But what if you put all these makaras together, and there are more, if you listen to that shir by Rabbi Simon, he doesn't have these, but he has several more makaros from later Acharnim. What is one of the themes of Sukkot? So what is a sukkah and a dal minim supposed to remind us? Number one, about Eretz Yisrael in general. But number two, about the moment of conquest, about the moment of entering Eretz Yisrael, the effort we had to employ to go from the Midbar over the Yarden and to take over Eretz Yisrael. Good. Then it makes even more sense. Why the Mordim, why the rebels, why the people during the Mered Gadol and Mered Bar Kokhba use the Dal and Minim as a symbol? Because it's not just to remind them about Eretz Yisrael in general. This is a symbol of conquering Eretz Yisrael. It's a symbol of building up Eretz Yisrael. It's a symbol of entering Eretz Yisrael. They were already living in Eretz Yisrael, but it was under foreign sovereignty. They wanted to do their own conquest. They wanted to do their own Yericho. They wanted to do their own Kibush of Yehoshua against the Romans. Therefore, the lulav and esrog, Sukkot, becomes a perfect symbol for their initiative. Good. Up until now, it's an interesting idea about Sukkot. It might be a new perspective, might be an older perspective, might be something you're familiar with, might be something you're not familiar with. It's something interesting to think about as we're sitting under the Sukkah, particularly here in Eretz Israel. What's interesting about this is that these ideas were taken from the theoretical realm and made extremely, extremely practical by people in the 1800s and on who were making aliyah, who wanted to come to Eretz Israel to rebuild the Jewish settlement here in the land of Israel. Let's start with source number 12. So if just before we just the background, before we get to any sources, who was the? Anybody know? Who in the 1800s instigated, motivated, was the ideological leader behind a movement of Ashkenazi Jews to make Aliyah? The Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon lived in the years from 1720 to 1799. So he lived in the 18th century. He did not make it into the 1800s from 1720 to 1799. He was a big, big lover of Eretz Yisrael. If you go through his writings, it's Eretz Yisrael is a major theme. The Chashivas of Eretz Yisrael is a major theme. He himself wanted to make Aliyah. He actually bought a ticket. He actually traveled to a port city. And then from the port city, instead of taking the boat to Eretz Yisrael, he traveled back to Vilna. Nobody really knows what happened. The Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist. His sons say that he had a dream or something, the Siman Min HaShemayim, that he wasn't supposed to go. But if you're familiar with the Igeres Hagra, with the letter the Vilna Gaon, sent to his family, it's a very harsh letter. It says like it's better not to go to shul because people speak Lashon Hara there. The Gra was a parish. He was an ascetic. He was parish min olam hazeh as much as possible. If these stories are true, even if they're not true, they can't be exaggerating too much. He slept like 4 hours a night. He only ate bread that was soaked in water so that he would be able to chew it for less time so that he can enjoy the bread less. He literally sat in a room his entire life outside of yeshivos and learned. He had maybe his sons count around 11 Talmidim that he had who were worthy of studying with the Vilna Gaon. He was known as a chassid from Vilna, as the, you know, everybody knew he was the he was a special person. He didn't have a major influence in his own lifetime, but his students went out to basically change the course of European Jewry. Chaim Voloshin was one of his major students, who started the Yeshivas Voloshin, which reinvented the whole notion of a yeshiva. The Vilna Gaon tried to make Aliyah, it didn't work. In 1808, 10 years after the Vilna Gaon passes away, some of his students, some of the six remaining students who are alive from his small country of students, make Aliyah. First they settle in Tveria, then they move from Tveria to Tzfat, then they move from Tzfat to Yerushalayim, and they become what's known as the Yishuv HaYashan, the community of the Prushim, the community that was in Eretz Israel from the early 1800s, and then when the new Zionists come, secular Zionists, religious Zionists come in the, you know, the early 1900s, they're the ones who clash with them. They're saying, like, we were here for 100 years, we have our way of life, we have our way of doing things, and all of a sudden these people are coming in with these nationalistic, you know, secular ideas, and that's when some fights started. When Rav Kook was appointed to be the Rav Rashi, to be the chief rabbi of the British Mandate of Palestine in 1919, the Prushim, the Yeshiva Yashan, they appointed Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld to be the head of the Eid HaRedus, and that's what became the Eid HaRedus Ad Yom Hazeh. So they have a long history of being in Yerushalayim. The question is, what motivated the Graf? What motivated the Vilna Gaon to try to make Aliyah himself, and what motivated his students to try to make Aliyah? So, is a machlokas among both Rashi Yeshiva and among historians. This is going to be one line of thinkers among the historians and one line of thinkers among the Rashi Yeshiva are trying to piece together what the Vilna Gaon was up to, what the Vilna Gaon was doing. Look at source number 12, Dereish Letzion. Dereish Letzion is a book that compiled a lot of drushos from this community over the course of 100 years. So you had people who got up in their shuls in Yerushalayim who darshan things. No, they gave drushos, they gave sermons. And they also collected different statements and sayings and testimonies and memorials from this community. Again, it's hard to know what's reliable 100% and what's not. But this is one of the testimonies that gets recorded in this book. Look at Os Yud Aleph, source number 12. Shlosha psukim shagra yachozer leim b'chol yom. There are three psukim that Vilna Gaon used to repeat daily. Al pi talmidav. This is based on his students. Hagra yachozer al psukim ha'ele b'chol yom. The Vilna Gaon would review these psukim on a daily basis. What was the first pasuk he would review on a daily basis? Vayhi b'shalem suko. Hashem was in his sukkah in Yerushalayim. And his dwelling place was in Tzion. So Hashem was in his abode, sukkah literally meaning abode, in Shalem, in Yerushalayim. His dwelling place, Tzion, was in Tzion. Great. Nice pasuk can tell him. The Perek seems to be talking about some type of war that Hashem intervenes in. According to Rashi, it's the war of Sancheirev. According to other Mepharshim, I think that the Radak says it's about Muhammad's Gog and Magog in the future. But what is it about this pasuk, about Hashem living in his sukkah in Tzion, is so important that at least according to some of the students of the Vilna Gaon, used to repeat this pasuk on a daily basis? Look at the next line. V'hosif al zeh, the Vilna Gaon would add on, sukkah mitzvasa ta'asev v'lo min ha'asui. A sukkah must be ta'asev v'lo min ha'asui. Anybody know what that means? Ta'asev v'lo min ha'asui? You have to build it, and it can't already be built. You have, basically, if you have pre-existing tzchach, which is hanging mid-air, you can't just build walls underneath and have your sukkah be kosher. The main part of the sukkah is the tzchach. You have to actively put the tzchach on. Ta'aseh, you have to do it, v'lo min ha'asui, not something that was already made. So tzukkah, it says, tzchach v'sukkos ta'aseh v'cha, you should create the holiday of sukkahs, you should create the sukkah. Ta'asev lo min ha'asui, you have to be active. You have to build the sukkah yourself. Af tzion kach. This pasuk puts in the same words, Yerushalayim, sukkahs, and tzion. The same way a sukkah is ta'asev lo min ha'asui, you have to build it yourself. So too with tzion, ta'asev lo min ha'asui. You have to build it yourself. It's not going to happen by itself. It's not going to happen on its own. You can't be passive. What does that sound like? Sounds like Zionism, right? This is why when these types of writings from the Vilna Gaon came out, there was a big backlash, because people are like, you know, these testimonies, and we'll see in a second the whole book, sort of make Devil Nagon sound like an early Zionist. Good. But this seems to be the mentality of at least a group of students of the Vilna Gaon who made Aliyah. What was motivating them when they made Aliyah in 1808, when there was nothing in Yerushalayim for Ashkenazi Jews? Tasev Laman Asoy. They were going to build up Yerushalayim. They were going to actively build up the Yishuv, build up the settlement in Eretz Israel. Let's before we look at the actual writings of students of the Vilna Gaon, let's look at a fundraising letter they sent out. This is in 1850. This is around 40 years after the make Aliyah. This is, if I recall correctly, this is a fundraising letter to build the Chorva Shul. Are you guys familiar with the Chorva Shul in the Old City? So the history of it was that it was built by Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, who was made Aliyah in the 1600s. He took out loans to build it. If I recall correctly, he didn't have enough money to pay back the loans. So it was destroyed by the Ottomans, whoever's in charge of Israel at the time. I'm forgetting already. And there was a ban against Ashkenazim in Yerushalayim until Ashkenazi Jews paid off these debts of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. Ashkenazi Jews, the students of the Vilna Gaon, came to Yerushalayim in the 1810s. I'm forgetting exactly which year. Somehow or other, they got permission from the government to do it. During the 1850s, they already built a small shul in the chatzer of the Chorva Shul. The Chorva Shul is still in ruins. They built a small shul in the chatzer of the Chorva Shul. Comes the 1850s, they feel confident enough to actually rebuild the Chorva Shul that was destroyed, and they do it. They rebuild the Chorva Shul. It's still known as the Chorva Shul. Then what happens to the Chorva Shul? When does it become a Chorva again? You know, 1948, Mechamet Shechor, the Jordanians bomb the city. The Chorva Shul gets destroyed. And then if you go to Yerushalayim now, the Chorva Shul is rebuilt. It was rebuilt in the last 10 years. So I think 2010, it was completed. And now you could go in. There's a kolo there. There's a Zilberman kolo. It's a functioning shul with a kolo there. But that's like it's a shul that really embodies the history of the old city of Yerushalayim. So if I recall correctly, this is a fundraising letter particularly for the shul. So let's look at the language they send back to Europe to raise funds. Mira Keila, Amar Letzion. Who saw things like this? We say to Tzion, Miaz Galus Aretz, V'tavav Aretz Shareb, in a time of the Galus, Livnos Beis Zvul Mikdash Ma'at, to build a Mikdash Ma'at, to build a shul in Yerushalayim. Shahar Hamira Sekanta, because it was so dangerous to build a shul there. Afila Bechandri Chadarim, even have a shul in hiding. Miyatzarim Atzorim, from the non-Jews that afflicted us. The Ata, and now, Rama Karnino Bashem Elokeinu. We are gaining in our pride. We're rising and our horn is rising. For Uko Ami Aretz Kishem Hashem Nikaralinu Ashivino Naklas Abosinu. We're returning to our Israel. Kilule Hashem Chafetz Banu. Lo Herenu Es Kaila. Lavienu El Menucha Vel Anachala. If Hashem didn't want us to be here, He wouldn't have given us so much success. He wouldn't have allowed us, the Ashkenazi community, to settle resettlement on Yerushalayim, where it was prohibited for close to 100 years. And He wouldn't have permitted us to build a small shul in the chatzir of the Chorva Shul. Simna milsahi aschalta de geula. What is this a simon for? Aschalta de geula, the beginning of redemption. What's going on? This is a fundraising letter they send back to Europe to raise funds for the Chorva Shul. What are they, this group of students of the Vilna Gaon, what do they clearly have in their mentality? What are they doing to leave Europe, to come to Eretz Yisrael where there was nothing, to live in abject poverty, and to try to buy as much property in Yerushalayim as possible? Eschalta de geula. Right, this is like pre-modern Zionism. This is the Zionism of the Prussian, of the people who ended up becoming the anti-Zionists, in terms of the state, in terms of a secular state. But in terms of at least the building up of the land, the material building up of the land, the fact that you have to have Jewish homes in Yerushalayim, and we have to be the ones to actively do this, and Jews in Europe should be funding it, that is something that is clearly part of this mentality. And which pasuk did the Vilna Gaon connect it to? Vahi b'shalem suko umonasot tzion. Sukkah is tasev l'manasoi. Sukkah requires an active building. So too tzion requires an active building. We have to be the ones to materially, to actively build up the land. Let's just read a little bit more from the writings from the writings of some of the students of the Vilna Gaon. Look at source number 14. This is the book Kol HaTorah. I think I mentioned it in one of my classes. If you go to the Kol HaTorah Wikipedia page, you could find out the controversy surrounding this book. The book was only published in the year 1947, which is important, whether it was published for the first time before the Mechamat HaShakur, before the State of Israel. But the author, the person who published the book, claimed that it was a manuscript that he had in his family dating back to Rahilo Rivlin, who was possibly one of the students of the Vilna Gaon who came to Israel. And what the book claims is that Rav Hillel of Rivlin, who made Aliyah in the 1810s, was a student of the Vilna Gaon. Now, Ruby Rivlin, the current president of Israel, comes from this family. He comes from a family, one of the students of the Vilna Gaon, who made Aliyah in the early 1800s. He's very proud of the fact. He speaks about it from time to time. But this was the Mesorah in the family. Rav Hillel of Rivlin sat down with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon explained to him why he wanted his students to make Aliyah in the early 1800s. Let's read the opening chapter of Kol HaTorah together. Bamidaseinu asaf askalta tegula. This is the students of the Vilna Gaon writing in the name of the Vilna Gaon. Again, this has been challenged both by some academics and by some Rosh Yeshiva. Just to note, Rav Chaim Friedlander, who was a Mashgiach Kampanovich, published the first critical edition with footnotes of the book Kol HaTorah. So he thought it was authentic. Again, we don't have time to go into the controversy, but let's just leave it at least some of the students of the Vilna Gaon thought that this is why the Vilna Gaon was encouraging them to make Aliyah. We are standing at the edge of the beginning of redemption. What is Eitas Higia? Kol HaTorah, where does the phrase Kol HaTorah come from? Anybody know? Pasuk and Shir Shirim. Shir Shirim is this love story between a dod and a ra'aya, between a male figure and a female figure. And they're constantly talking to each other, talking about each other, and they hardly ever actually meet. So at one point, the dod says the following to the ra'aya. The male figure, representing God, says the following thing to the ra'aya, according to Chazal, refers to the Jewish people. Ana dodiv amarli. The dod who said to me, Kumilach, get up, ra'yasiya fasiya l'chilach. Get up, my beautiful ra'aya, and go. Why? Because the fall has passed. Hageshem chalaf alachlo. The rain is no longer there. Hanitzanim niru ba'aretz. The sprouts are seen in the land. Eta zamir higia. The time of the song, the time of the gathering, has arrived. The kol hator nishma be'artinu. And the voice of the turtle dove has arrived in our land. So what's the imagery here? The fall and the winter are gone. The spring is here. The turtle doves are back. Things are sprouting. Get up and go. Each of the Rishonim has a different explanation as to what's going on. I think I'm dating myself probably. Anybody here listen to Mordechai Ben David? Yeah? So he has a song on this Pasuk. The call of Tor Nishma Be'artzenu, the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. What's that referring to according to one Medrash? It's a Kol HaShamelech HaMashiach. That Hashem is saying, the fall is gone, the winter is gone, things are sprouting, things are moving. The voice of Mashiach is here. Kol HaTorah Nishma Be'artzenu. The voice of the turtle dove is chirping. It's time to go back. It's time to get up and leave Galus and go back to Eretz Yisrael. The Vilna Gaon is telling his students, based on whatever Kabbalistic calculations he had, the 1800s, time of a lot of fermentation, a lot of movement in the world, a lot of change. This is the beginning of Ashkanta Zagula. This is the Eitas Zemir. This is a time when we have to go back to Eretz Yisrael and start rebuilding the land a little bit. The Fi Mitzvahs Rabbeinu Agra, based on the commandment of our teacher, the Vilna Gaon, V'chasala Kedosha, V'stiyata D'Shmaya, and his holy blessing with the help of Hashem, Shrikam Anu Lilmod L'Havin is Kol Darkeha Ikvos D'Mashika. We have to learn the pathways, the methods, what's going to happen in Ikvos D'Mashika. And what's going to happen in the future? The Vilna Gaon represented the beginning of a time period of Mashiach ben Yosef, whatever that means. Again, maybe before Yom HaTzimut, we can go through this more. We can go through the way modern religious Zionist Jews understand Kol HaTorah and the history of religious Zionism from the Vilna Gaon through Rav Kook out of Yom HaZeh. But the Vilna Gaon represents the beginning of a time period of Mashiach ben Yosef. He taught us the secrets of Geula he taught us that now is a time period when we have to start going back to Eretz Yisrael, and we have to start rebuilding the land. So what do? They went. They tried to start some agricultural stuff. That stuff failed. They tried to raise as much funds as possible to buy as many apartments as possible in the old city. And as you saw in that letter, they were referring to that as a Schalta Degula. It wasn't just Jews buying a shul in Yerushalayim. The Ramban had a shul in Yerushalayim. Great. Good. He had a shul in Yerushalayim. For them, buying a shul in Yerushalayim, buying the Chur of a shul and rebuilding it, was a step in the Messianic process, a step in the rebuilding of Eretz Israel. We're not going to have time to go through the major points of Kol HaTorah. I did hope to have some time to go through some of the points, but turn the page for a second to source number 18. It's in this context that the connection between Sukkah and Eretz Yisrael was highlighted by the Vilna Gaon. Look at source number 18. The Elohim Shivas Ikari and Yisodos Bishitas Ikvasa de Mashiach. These are the seven principles of Ikvasa de Mashiach that the Vilna Gaon taught us that we have to be aware of when we're returning to Eretz Yisrael. Look at number 2. Asei v'hitzliach. You should act and be successful. One of the characteristics of Mashiach ben Yosef, Hatzlacha ayidei asiya. Again, this is not Mashiach, this is the precursor to Mashiach, it's a time period before Mashiach actually comes. But what do we know about Yosef in the Chumash? There's a pasuk. Kol Hashem oseh, Hashem matzliach biyado. Everything Yosef did, Hashem was matzliach, Hashem caused him success. Emphasis on oseh. He's active, he does. He's not just waiting passively for things to happen. Yosef is a mover and a shaker. Vinoza the Miskov, second line, Divar Rabinu. Everybody knows what the Vilna Gaon said. Shtei ha-mitzvot she'adam nichnas behen shalei mechol gufo. There are only two mitzvot in the entirety of Tayag mitzvot that a person fully enters with their entire body. Hein sukkah to Eretz Yisrael. Sukkah, you enter with your entire body. In Yishev Eretz Yisrael, you enter with your entire body. V'remez nasan lezeh b'pasuk. What is the remez for this? That pasuk the Vilna Gaon used to repeat daily. Hashem's sukkah is in Yerushalayim, and his abode, his dwelling place, is in Tzion. V'hosif, sukkah mitzvasa tasev v'amana asoi, af Tzion kein. We have to be active, like Yosef, in rebuilding Tzion, same way we have to be active in rebuilding our sukkah. V'chamar b'medrash, al pasuk uval Tzion goel, that goel will come to Tzion. What did Vilna Gaon read of it? The Goel comes to Tzion. The Goel doesn't come to build up Tzion. The Goel comes to an already built up Tzion. The Goel comes to Tzion, to Yerushalayim that's already built up. Kol zaman sheTzion eina bunuya, adayin Goel lo ba. If it's not yet Tzion, if it's not yet built up, if it's not yet a metropolis, if it's not yet a Jewish city, then the Goel, then Mashiach, is not going to come. So what's going on? Just tying different pieces together. We have a mitzvah of Sukkah and a mitzvah of Da'alamina. We know that the Mordim, from the Great Rebellion against Rome, two Great Rebellions against Rome, the one from the Beit Hamikdash was destroyed, and the one from Ered Bar Kokhba, saw the Da'alamina as a symbol of conquest of Eretz Yisrael. It represented Eretz Yisrael, it represented their desire to be sovereigns over Eretz Yisrael. We know that many Rishonim speak about that the Dalan Minim and the Mitzvah of Sukkah, the holiday of Sukkot, is a way of giving thanks to Hashem for Eretz Yisrael. Other Rishonim refine it a little bit more. The Sukkah is a way of reminding us of the time period when we entered Eretz Yisrael, what we had to go through to cross the Yarden, what we had to go through to be Yoresh and ultimately be Yoshev in Eretz Yisrael. The Vilna Gaon, 1800 years after these great rebellions, looks at the Mitzvah of Sukkah and derives the same exact theme, the same exact idea. What does the mitzvah of Sukkah represent for him? The fact that now is the time to return to Eretz Yisrael, and now is the time to re-enter the land in an active way. Tasev lo mina asoi. We have to go there actively and rebuild it. We can't passively wait for Mashiach. Can't passively wait for Mashiach to come. So this theme of Sukkot, that the Sukkot is a holiday of Jewish people entering Eretz Yisrael, giving hodah to Hashem, but also focusing on what we have to do as people to be able to enter the land, be able to be zocha to the land, and be able to live here in peace and security, That's a theme of Sukkot, of Dalaminim, the mitzvah of Sukkah, from Bayit Sheni, from the end of Bayit Sheni, all the way through the Vilna Gaon. And if we had more time, you could show all the way through modern religious Zionist thought. So, again, this is not the only theme of Sukkot. You could develop many other themes of Sukkot. You could develop many other themes of the Dalaminim, and there are many other themes of Sukkot. And I figured for us, well, here in Eretz Israel, for you guys, many of you, it's probably your first Sukkot here. For me, it's my third Sukkot here as a citizen of this place. It's just an interesting thing, an important thing to think about as we're sitting under the Sukkot, as we're taking the Dal Aminim. In addition to all the personal meaning that we have in Rana Buddhas Hashem in Sukkah and Lulav and Esrog, it's also giving thanks to Hashem for Eretz Israel and reminding us what we have to do in order to have a proper yeshiva here in Eretz Israel. Thank you so much, and lunch is being served.